This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camaro.
All right, we're back doing one of our very favorite things we love to do, which is an awesome coincidence because we know you guys love it too. The return of Albums Unleashed, and man, we got a killer one to talk about today. This is the Decibel Geek Podcast. In case you didn't know, my name is Aaron Camaro, and I'm always joined by my awesome friend and kick-ass co-host, Mr. Chris Sinzak. What's going on, Chris?
I'm just excited to talk to this guest this week. I think you guys are going to enjoy this one.
So I can tell you this, album came out in right in my timeline. You know, I'm just barely out of high school. And, you know, this is a time that's so important in music. It's 1995, you know, and there's so much happening. And this was one man talking about Slash's Snake Pit. It's 5 o'clock somewhere. I bought it on day one. I was ready to listen to this thing. As soon as I saw the video for Beggars and Hangers-On, I was excited for it. I couldn't wait to get it. I loved it then. I love it now.
But I was in my senior year. I was in my last semester of high school when this came out. And I remember the hype building up for it before it came out. And I remember a lot of parties during that spring where this album was getting spun that I was hanging out at. And I also remember a lot of people predicting that this album would signify the end of Guns N' Roses. And for a long time, it kind of was.
Yeah, it's true. We're going to find out all about it, how Eric became a member of the band, how they wrote the songs, how they recorded the songs, how they went on tour, how they were compared to Guns N' Roses, all of it. He's an awesome guest, and he's telling some kick-ass stories. But before we get to all that, you know us. We're going to do it. That's right. We're taking care of the business of reviews and recommendations. We love them. If you want to give us one, you can do it on Apple Podcasts. You can do it at Podchaser. And we always love the Facebook recommendations. Do you need an example of exactly how it's done? Well, I'm about to lay it on you because I got two great ones right here. The first one's entitled Fresh Blood, April 2022. It's an Apple Podcast review. It's got all 5 stars, just the way we like it. And it goes a little something like this. Wow, what an episode. This was one of my favorites. This is a fantastic podcast for fans of rock and metal. I'm an old school rocker, so I know whereof I speak. It's so good to hear new bands carrying the torch for music that was so important to me as a kid. If you're lucky, you might even catch a round of Beat the Geek. Or an overview of an old Hit Parader or Circus magazine from back in the day. Straddling the line of classic and future rock, it's hard to deny Decibel Geek. Thanks, man. And that comes to us from Dean. It's a podcast review on Apple. Freaking awesome.
Great review. Thanks so much for writing that in, Dean. Awesome.
Yeah, very cool. So that's there you go. Now you know how it's done. Need another example? Oh, perfect. We've got a Podchaser review as well. The return of the reviews. I love it. This one comes to us from our awesome friend, Nate. You might know him better as Bushy. He's been on the show with us on Friday nights. We've had a good time with him. He took the time to leave us a Podchaser review. He put all 5 stars. We love him for it. And his review goes like this. Chris and Aaron always deliver quality content. From outstanding interviews to rock and metal news and their amazing Radio Sucks episodes. These guys always leave you wanting more.
I always believe everything Bushy says.
Oh, totally. Well, except for that time he was trying to tell us about the Spin Doctors. But other than that...
Well, questionable musical taste, but he's a good guy.
Yeah, we love him. Check out his show, The Plug Podcast with Metal Mike. A couple of hard rockers like us. Good dudes. They're having fun over there, so if you're loving what we're doing here, you got a little extra time, a little extra room in your cache for podcasts to check out, that's a good one to go do it with, because if you love hard rock and metal, you're going to love those guys, because they do too.
Definitely.
So there you go. Those are our sweet reviews and recommendations for the week. Like I said, if you want to leave us one, simple. Give us 5 stars. Give us a nice review. It can be long and epic. It can be short and sweet. But if you give us all 5 stars, we're going to read it on the show. and show our appreciation to you for taking the time to do it. Podchaser, Apple Podcasts, Facebook recommendations. Give it to us. So if you think that's a good way to help us out, well, check this out. This is another way you can do it. Every time we come out with a brand new episode, we always make the announcements on Facebook and on Twitter. So if you happen to be on either one of those and you see that post come up, hey, it's a new Decibel Geek podcast. They're doing Albums Unleashed with Eric Dover talking about Slash's Snake Pit. How cool. I want to share this with my friends, or I got to retweet this. Well, when you do that, we get the list of people that do it, and we love them, and that's why we make them honorary Geeks of the Week.
Geeks of the Week this week are Adam Cox, Rock and Ron Runyon, Kristen Schimbeck, Pantheon Podcast, Shay Hargett, Jeffrey Mendenhall, Chris Fretwell, Sit and Spin with Joe, David Glenn, Mark and Jerry BS Sessions, Freeform Rock Podcast, Mark Alden Taylor, Mike Parnell, David Cathy, Will Honeycutt, Joseph Capone, Hakon Bergstad, Ernesto Aguiar, Lil Willie A to Z, Eladio, James McElhinney, Jay Shabluski, Doug Fox, Kevin's on Fire, Mikhail Burrell, Keith Rockford, Vet Halen, Scott Crouch, and as always,
the Mooger Fooger. That's right. Those are our people. We've been doing it since the very, very beginning of this show, Geeks of the Week. We love it when you share with your friends what we got going on here at the Decibel Geek Podcast, because we figure if you're listening to us, you got to be cool as hell. That means you got to at least have a couple of cool friends, and they're going to see it, and maybe they got a couple of cool friends. It all comes together. We make this big old huge thing, and it shows everybody that rock and metal music is still damn important in the modern age. And so we keep pushing that out to people. Next thing you know, Judas Priest is in the Hall of Fame. We did it. We did it, everybody.
Don't get me started on that place.
All right. So instead of doing all that, let's talk about an album I feel like should be in the Hall of Fame of your collection. If you collect music and you love rock, you got to own this one, I'm telling you. So, Chris, are you ready? Because I know I sure am.
Yeah, let's do it.
It's Albums Unleashed on the Decibel Geek Podcast. Slash's Snake Pit. It's 5 o'clock somewhere with the amazing Eric Dover. All right, so, I mean, when we started doing Albums Unleashed episodes every so often, I had, like, a short list of albums that I really wanted to do, and we've done Warrant's Dog Eat Dog with Michael Wagner, we've done Skid Row's Slave to the Grind with Rachel Bolan, we've done Motley Crue 94 with John Corabi, so I'm running right down the list, and today I'm checking another one off that was on that list that I always wanted to do, an album I love a lot. Came out in February in 1995 on Geffen Records, talking about It's 5 O'Clock Somewhere. We got the man right here that sang the vocals, wrote a bunch of the songs, and man, one of my all-time favorite singers and performers, Eric Dover. Welcome to the Decibel Geek Podcast.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here, and thanks for the kind words. You know, that record's been around for a number of years now, and I'm very happy with the way it's held up.
Yeah, it's one of those that I don't think there's a bad song on it, and I can pop it in today just like I did back in the mid-90s and enjoy it just as much. So you're originally from Alabama, right?
That's correct, yeah. A town called Jasper.
Jasper. Chris, you were telling me about a movie you just saw about Jasper.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you seen the documentary Jasper Mall that came out a couple of years ago?
Oh, yes. I know that mall very well. And it's kind of sad, but it's still really, yeah. What Jasper has a very storied history. So if you look into it, there's a lot that's happened there historically, and not much going on. But that's where I'm from.
Is that where you used to buy your records when you were a kid?
At Jasper Mall, absolutely. Every day after school, I would be at the record store, and you know, talking. Always had friends that worked at the store, so I would go, you know, hey, what's new, what can I buy? And then most of the time I would just go there after school and browse around and look at covers of albums and go, should I buy that? Because that's how you did it back in the day, too. Yep. You would look at the cover and go, what's this all about?
I mean, that's how we all became big Kiss fans, you know, by looking at the album covers.
Right. That's right. And, you know, the cutout bin was really important. I discovered a lot of music in the cutout bin. So,
what kind of stuff were you into back then?
Well, I grew up on rock and roll. I had an older sister. She got me into Kiss and Alice Cooper, Nazareth. We got into AC/DC and Van Halen. Then I discovered Yngwie Malmsteen and decided I couldn't play guitar anymore. And but about the time that high school rolled around, I was getting into other music as well, like The Police, Thomas Dolby, a lot of new wave stuff. And at the same time, I was studying classical guitar and listening to some jazz fusion. I was really hungry for music when I was young.
Nice.
That's awesome.
So one thing I always wonder about, especially people, you know, from, you know, that were in that era and not already in L.A., what does it take for you to go to L.A.? Do you just pick up and go? Do you got somebody there you know? I mean, it's always, it's a huge step for somebody to come from a small town in some other state and head out to the Sunset Strip.
Well, I was blessed to not have a lot of good sense in my youth. And so I came to L.A. after Jellyfish disbanded. As you know, I played with them for about a year, a little over a year. And it just seemed to me that that was the place to be. I'd always wanted to go to either L.A. or New York, but I decided on L.A., and the reason I did was because of Frank Zappa. Because I figured that all the best musicians in the world must be in L.A. because Frank Zappa is in L.A., so I wanted to come out here and get in the mix, so to speak.
You ever get to meet him, Frank Zappa?
No, I haven't, but I've met a number of the band members from the 1988 touring band. I had the privilege of performing with them at the Whiskey about a year ago. Mike Keneally and Scott Tunis, and just I've never seen a more powerful display of musicianship in my life. It was completely humbling.
Wow. So Zappa, your guy? Is that your number one, your favorite?
No, not exactly. Okay. I just grew up on Zappa. You know, I think that was the first kind of instrumental musical, you know, musoid thing. A lot of my friends were into Yes and ELP and acts like that. And I really loved that music as well. But Zappa really touched me early on. So that and, you know, I wanted to be a good musician as a kid. I didn't necessarily want to be famous. I wanted to be as the best musician I could be. So always looked up to people that I could learn from. So those Zappa records I learned a lot from.
Right on. So what's your plan heading to L.A.?
There was no plan. Roger Manning from Jellyfish called me on the day that Kurt Cobain died. And he said, come out here, let's write some songs and see what happens. So I packed everything that I had up in 1985 Ford Bronco and headed west, and had about $300 in my pocket, and got there and, you know, did the whole thing that everybody does when they come here. You sleep on couches and you might sleep in a rehearsal space or two, but you're doing what you want to do, which is music.
Wow. So then, the Jellyfish thing, you know, Peter's out, and then as I understand it, it was Gilby Clark's drummer that got you hooked up with the Slash gig. Is that true?
Right, Mark Danzeisen. I was rehearsing with Roger at the Mates rehearsal, which is pretty much the Guns N' Roses rehearsal space. And Mark said, hey, Slash is looking for a singer. Why don't you audition? And I got Roger's blessing to do that, because we were really knee-deep in writing material for Imperial Drag at that time.
Yeah.
And so I hooked up with Adam Day, who is Slash's guitar tech, or was, and went over to Slash's house, and the first song was Beggars and Hangers-On. Nice.
It's a great song. Great song. So is that so you say Roger gave you the blessing, because like Imperial Drag gets put on hold once you get that gig, right?
Yes, it did. It got put on hold at least for a year, And we were inking a deal with Sony at the time. So I signed the Imperial Drag deal in Rotterdam, Holland, of all places, in a hotel room. So I was kind of doing double duty. And, you know, we went into the whole Slash project knowing that it was going to have a beginning, middle, and end. And so that's kind of how that worked out.
Yeah. Now, I understand that there was like over 40 singers that were auditioned for this thing. So, like, I mean, obviously, you know, Slash is one of the biggest rock stars in the world at the time that you hear about this audition. How intimidated were you going into this thing? Because, I mean, you were a backup vocalist for Jellyfish. You weren't the lead guy. So were you like, I mean, what, did you have high hopes for this? Or are you just like, what the hell, I'll try out. He's not going to pick me.
Well, my mindset going into it was always, let's see what kind of good time we can have, you know. Mm-hmm. Time to do some sketchy shit. Let's see how it goes. Right. And so I really felt very little pressure because I grew up playing and singing in rock bands. And that was something that I actually had a hold on, more so than Jellyfish, which was a completely different animal. So I kind of went into it like, you know, just let's see what kind of music we can make. What kind of fun can we have? And, you know, that was good because Slash is very mellow, you know, very helpful. And we hit it off pretty well. So completing the songs was just sort of, you know, day by day, taking a song in the studio. I would sit up in a room and at Rumbo Recorders, which it's no longer there. And write lyrics, just write lyrics. No TV, nothing, just coffee and a sheet of paper. So we kind of fleshed out the lyrics to the songs together that way.
Nice. Do you know of anybody else that tried that?
No, I don't. I know nothing about anything that happened before that. But I'm, you know, 40 singers. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. I got to imagine out of them 40, there's probably some pretty well-known people that wanted that gig.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, even with Jellyfish, they had an open audition for guitarists, and I managed to make it into the band. So, you know, I was a lot luckier when I was younger. Now that I'm older, it's I have to use, you know, old age and treachery.
That's awesome. So, I mean, it seems like you guys bang out these songs really fast, right?
Yes, it has to be immediate, at least with in the mindset that we have when it comes to rock and roll. Like, you really have to shoot from the hip, and I don't mean like today's music is. There's a lot of really great metal bands, for example, but you can tell they really have to put in the time to make their music happen. We were really influenced by the Rolling Stones and the New York Dolls and the Sex Pistols. And so we really wanted it off the cuff, you know, shooting from the hip as much as possible. So you can't take a lot of time. It has to be right there. You have to be inspired.
Yeah. And I was reading some interviews with Slash from around the time period that this came out, and it was kind of the overarching thing was, you know, because, I mean, Guns N' Roses had come off the Use Your Illusion albums and some Spaghetti Incident and stuff. And it just seemed like the main thrust of what he wanted to do with this record is just be immediate with it and just do it basically off vibe and just have a good time. And which is probably the way they did it in the early days of Guns N' Roses. And I think he felt that they had kind of gotten a little too overdramatic with the overall production of stuff. And this album it's very bare bones. It's in your face. And it just sounds like a group of guys getting together and having fun to me.
Well, we just, I mean, everyone universally loves Appetite for Destruction. And what I think really holds up so well about it is that it's so organic, and that's not even the word I would like to use. It just sounds like a bunch of guys got in the studio and hit record. And there's such a charm to something like that. Nowadays you have the producer show up and go, okay, we've got a click track for you. And you know, we're going to put everything in Beat Detective and everything's going to be perfect. And which is a little bit of a gripe today about rock and roll for me is it's just too perfect. I want to hear imperfections, because I'm totally imperfect and, you know, I got to go with my kind of people.
And you know what? 9 times out of 10, that's where the magic happens. You know, you can't overthink rock and roll. It's like we've talked to, you know, famous producers that we said, this part in the song is amazing. How did that happen? And they go, oh, well, that was a fuck up. But it was so cool, we left it in. And it's like, that's rock and roll.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I couldn't imagine listening to a Lou Reed record and thinking that they must have went in and, you know, edited all the drums to be perfect. And, you know, the feel and the flow of everything is always changing and morphing. And you really get attached to something like that once you listen to it a few times.
Yeah. And I think I remember at the time when the album was coming out, you guys were doing an interview and Slash said something like talking about Beggars and Hangers On the video. And he's like, yep, no dolphins in it. And he would say shit like that. And I remember reading at the time, probably in a Metal Edge magazine, that a lot of these songs were stuff that he presented to Axl. And Axl's like, no. But I remember getting the album and thinking, this is a perfect Guns N' Roses album almost.
Yeah, it just goes to show you that when you have a band, you know, you can have people that are, you know, both extremely talented, but they have different mindsets and they don't always meet up. In the case of Snake Pit, you know, I pretty much knew from the very beginning that there was going to have to be another Guns N' Roses record. And that's one of the reasons I kind of approached it with just trying to have as much fun and learn and perform for people and as much as I can, because I knew eventually that people were going to want GNR back. So I was thrown to the wolves and I enjoyed every minute of it. But, you know, they do have a special relationship, those guys. So it's good to see that they're back in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine back then that they would have gotten it back together again and they're going forward again? I mean, I never, that's one reunion I didn't expect to ever happen, and I'm kind of surprised it did. I'm glad it did, but it was surprising.
Yeah, it was very surprising, and sometimes you just need, you need space, you know. You're the biggest band in the world, then all of a sudden you find out you're just not getting along with where you want to go musically, and sometimes a break is good, so...
Man, in your situation, that's got to take a ton of pressure off, knowing for sure that, you know, it's not like you're, all right, I'm joining this band and I hope we're going to go to number one and I hope we're going to, you know, this is going to last forever. It's got to take a ton of pressure off you, right?
Yeah, it took a lot of pressure off of me, and I'm very glad for that. You know, I think when it comes to anything in this business, you really don't know. You don't know if one day you're going to be, you know, topping the charts, and the next minute, nobody's going to, you won't be able to get arrested. You know, everybody's been through this before. But if you don't give up and you keep trucking along, then, you know, good things can only happen.
Yeah. And I got to, you know, because like Axl's got his own reputation, but like Slash almost seems like the polar opposite of Axl to work with. It just seems like he didn't really fall for the rock star trip. He didn't become a diva. He just, especially the interviews you read, he was at the height of his fame back then, and he just seemed like a regular guy. Just wanted to play guitar and, you know, have a smoke and a whiskey and just relax. Is that really the private Slash? He was pretty much what you see is what you get back then.
Oh, definitely. And that's one of the reasons we hit it off so well, because we're both massive Rolling Stones fans. You know, I still consider them the greatest rock and roll band in the world, bar none. And I have a lot of favorite rock and roll bands, but rock and roll is an attitude, and Slash had the attitude from the very get-go. And, you know, he's always going to have that, you know, whether he's hanging out with Ron Wood or Keith Richards, you know, they understand these things. So they know how to roll with the punches and not get flipped out.
Now, you know, so you guys made this for Geffen, which was Guns N' Roses' home record company and, you know, massive major label. And it was, I was, Eric and I, Aaron and I were talking before we went live. We were talking about how this album is, you know, this is a seriously long album. It's 14 tracks. It's almost 70 minutes long. I was just curious if Geffen, did Geffen have their hooks in, like, we want to control what this record is, or did they just kind of let you have carte blanche to do whatever you wanted?
Well, that's one of the good things about it, because Geffen's one of the majors back in the day that they really, at least with Slash, they kept their hands off of us. All they really wanted was a follow-up to Use Your Illusion. So they were kind of the mindset that, okay, we're going to let Slash do his record, and the, you know, maybe we'll get back to business with GNR. However, I must say that they promoted it very well. Yeah. I marvel at how much they promoted that record for us.
Yeah, because you would think if all they cared about was a new GNR, they'd just put you out there and be like, whatever, you know, we're not going to make no money off of this. But I remember seeing it in all the magazines and everything back then.
Yeah, they worked the record really well. They worked it as good as they would work a GNR record.
But then again, you still got Slash, you know, and at the time, he's one of the biggest stars and one of the, you know, massive rock stars of the time. So, you know, if there's money to be made, and it turned out to be a great album, you know, that's the other part of it, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, anybody that has a pet cougar is a rock star. That's the only thing I can say. And he did.
Really?
And boy, that thing. Yeah, Slash had a pet cougar named Curtis. And I would go over to his house and we'd sit around. I think Leif Garrett came by one day and we were all hanging around playing guitar. And Slash brings his pet cougar in. And he lays by the fireplace and he starts purring. And it sounds like a 59 Cadillac at idle. It's incredible. I don't know what he ever did with Curtis, but he was a sweet big kitty.
Wow. Pet cougar.
And you're set. I'm just thinking of you coming from Jasper, Alabama, and you're looking around and you're like, I'm in LA and I'm sitting in a house with Slash, Leif Garrett, and a cougar. What has happened to my life?
Well, I thought it was I definitely thought it was an improvement. So,
yeah, you're not going to find that in Alabama.
No,
definitely not in the Jasper Mall.
No. Yeah. You find other things, possums, you know.
Yeah. Well, can you talk about the chemistry between the band and the studio making this? Because, I mean, it was kind of you and a lot of GNR guys and, of course, Mike Inez on bass. What was the work environment like when you guys were putting this thing together?
Well, there wasn't a work environment. It was just Slash, Mike Klink, and myself to finish the vocals.
Oh, okay.
The tracks were already recorded. And, that's, you know, I got to meet the guys as we were going along, and everyone is super, you know. I still keep in touch with most everybody. Gilby, I keep in touch with the most. In fact, I just jammed with him last week.
Nice.
Oh, cool.
But it was really just a three-person process to complete the vocals.
And Mike Klink, what was it like to work with him?
Just a, you know, super fabulous, supportive person. And to have somebody behind the glass give you the right direction means everything, especially if you don't know where the hell you're going, which I really didn't at the time. I was just like, and you go, okay, that's good. Can you try it like this? And I go, okay, sure. So his direction was invaluable.
Sounds like he had a huge part in making that album sound the way it did. But I mean, I guess that's what Mike Klink does.
He had a huge part in everything to do with GNR, as far as I'm concerned. I have friends that knew him before GNR, and he's just the same. He's the same person. He just has a really good spirit about him, a really great energy.
So when it comes to Slash's attitude at this time, I mean, he knows this is a one-off thing too, and that he's obligated to go do more Guns N' Roses. But at the time, is he's got to be feeling it when this album's coming together. I mean, how good it really actually is, right? I mean, Is his feelings on this album pretty high?
We had very, very good feelings about it. We had high hopes for it. We really, I mean, they you got to understand that Guns N' Roses was in a really bad state of flux about that time. So there were arguments and phone calls made and all this. And I was privy to some of that, but I was always thinking, do not get involved. Do not get involved. And, you know, just sing, you know. Whatever their dynamic is, that's their dynamic. I didn't want to be involved in that.
Yeah, it's probably like the less you know, the better at that point in time, I'm sure.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that was a whirlwind for sure with the GNR camp during the couple of years. I mean, it was, because I remember as a rock fan, and I know Aaron will agree, you know, this came out my senior year of high school. And I remember going, wow, Slash is out on his own now. And that was like the big thing is like, is GNR done? You know, are they broken up? Are they going to get back together? And it was a really kind of a confusing time. But yeah, I remember, as you said earlier, this album got pushed really heavily. And I remember a lot of people buying it and really liking it that year.
Yeah. And I'm really thankful to all the GNR fans that were accepting, at least of me, because they were the hardest act to follow, period. At that time, you could not follow them at all.
No, not at that time. They were the biggest band in the world. You ever have anybody give you a hard time when you're out on tour and be like, oh, you're no Axl Rose or any bullshit like that?
Actually, I was kind of lucky there. I didn't really get a lot of that. You know, I have a lot of respect for Axl. I think he's an amazing singer, a great songwriter, an amazing front man, but I was still just a kid too, so anything anybody would have said probably wouldn't have bothered me that much.
And I think, you know, as a Guns N' Roses fan, when It's 5 o'clock Somewhere comes out, you know, and I loved Appetite and Use Your Illusion, I still say you could probably, you know, pick a bunch of songs out of there and make it into one really good album. But Snake Pit, when it came out, it had way more of a vibe of an Appetite for Destruction than, you know, what Guns N' Roses had become in Use Your Illusion. So, you know, that made me appreciate that much more as a Guns N' Roses fan. And I'd listen to Snake Pit and go, this is the kind of stuff I wish Guns N' Roses was. But I'm sure glad that Slash is out there doing it with somebody. And your vocal delivery and performance on that album is just out of this fucking world. So, you know, as a Guns N' Roses fan, man, I loved it. Loved it when it came out.
Awesome. Thanks. I mean, I remember hearing the tracks on playback when I first got involved and went, damn, this sounds good. I mean, it really, the guitar, the drum, the whole, it all just coalesced into this really beautiful sound. It was a little different than, say, Appetite, but it was hard hitting, and so, you know, that's one of the reasons I think that the record has held up so well. It just, everyone was in this certain mindset of sonics, if you will, to get this kind of certain sound, and it just really, you know, it was like music to my ears, so to speak.
Yeah, and I mean, Slash's playing is just insane on it. It's and then, you know, it's, I hear the elements of Appetite, but I mean, I even hear, you know, even some Southern rock influence on some of this stuff, you know. And Slash is also one of those guitar players where he came out during a very niche period of time for music, but he writes stuff and plays guitar in kind of a timeless fashion where it ages well. Like, you listen to this now and you wouldn't say, oh, that came out in the 90s. It could have easily come out in the 70s, especially on a lot of the riffs on that record, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's good arranging. And he's a really good arranger with what he does. I think that's, again, you know, with any great band, that arrangement is the king. So he's very conscious of those things.
What kind of feedback are you getting from everybody right at the time of release as far as media and stuff like that?
It was all very favorable. In fact, I think the only good review that I've ever had from Rolling Stone was the 5 o'clock Somewhere record. Everything else I've ever been involved with, they've hated. Not that it matters, but
that's a badge of honor.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you win some, you lose some, but yeah, it was well received. And we were on a jet, you know, smoking and drinking whiskey and going to exotic locations. So I really didn't give a shit. I was pretty happy.
Yeah, you're happy in your own shoes. Like, who cares what the critics say, right? I saw a thing on, there's a little bit of fact or fiction I want to play with you. Like, there was I saw something online said that the band name was supposed to be SVO Snake Pit for Slash's very own Snake Pit, but the record company made him call it Slash's Snake Pit. Is that true?
That's the first time I've ever heard that.
It could be BS because it's the internet. Who knows?
I don't know for sure. I'm glad that he just chose Slash's Snake Pit. The other thing.
Yeah, it has a better.
Yeah, it sounds like VC. It sounds like Studio Talk or some shit. I don't know. Like, yeah, you got a VSO, you know, like Variable Speed Oscillation.
Yeah.
You know?
I saw an interview with Matt Sorum about this record and about this period, and somebody had asked him about, like, you know, his involvement with side projects. He was promoting Neurotic Outsiders at the time, but as you know, he played on Snake Pit. But he said that Axl criticized solo projects from the other members. He hates Snake Pit, and he laughed when he said it. It was hard for me to deal with. Axl asked me not to go on tour with Slash. I didn't want to endanger Guns N' Roses. If I toured with Snake Pit, it could have caused serious consequences. It could have divided GNR. Do you remember this going down?
Yes, I do. It all kind of went down. You know, Axl was not a big fan, let's face it, for whatever reason. But I'm glad that things worked out the way that they did. I think that when you're young and you have a band and you really don't want people to stray outside and do anything else, it's not a good idea, really. You really need to let people have freedom, and that's just my opinion. Because I've been through this a few times with other bands, but there it is.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess I kind of understand it, because I mean, if you got Slash, you got Gilby. Imagine if Duff would have been involved in that, but Duff's out doing his own solo album at about the same time. You got Gilby involved in it. I mean, you almost got a new Guns N' Roses almost at that point, so people are going to speculate, and I can imagine Axl's probably not going to like that. I mean, it's the whole band with just a different singer. I mean, what does that say to him?
Well, it's understandable. You just have more variables that you have to rein in and control, you know. And, you know, if I were in Axl's position, I probably would have felt the same way. It's hard to say. You know, hindsight's 20/20. But when you get older, you kind of realize that if you, like the 38 Special song, hold on loosely but don't let go, you know. If you do that with people, then you're going to have a better time, I think. Because people tend to come around eventually, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not anything new. It happens in bands all the time where, you know, one member who might be the leader kind of squeezes a little too tightly on another member, and then that forces them out. I mean, just ask Metallica. Jason Newsted left for the same reason. You know, it happens a lot in bands, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, we have to face the fact that this is a certain amount of ego-driven business that we're in here. For anyone to say otherwise is lying. Yeah. Whether you're an indie folk artist or a giant, you know, rock star, there's still some ego in there, but you do have to kind of learn to live with your ego and control it, you know, and I say that about myself first and foremost.
Well, you know, ego and a competitive nature, I think.
Right, yeah. Competitive is another great word, because you're up against, 40 singers auditioning or whatever. Fortunately, I never knew that there were 40 singers auditioning, so that pressure was off of me. But
right.
You never know. Like, if you don't take that gig, or if, you know, somebody will take it. If you don't want it bad enough and you don't work hard enough for it, then somebody's going to want it.
Sure. And then the tour ends up going out with Brian Tichy on drums, who's an absolute monster. And then, of course, James Lomenzo on bass, who is an incredible player, too. I'm assuming Mike Inez probably had Alice in Chains commitments. Is that what led him to not be able to join you guys?
Right, yeah. But we lucked out because James and Tichy are, like you said, they're super, super amazing. And to hear that rhythm section cranking on a big stage was really something to behold.
Yeah.
So on this tour, are these, at this point, the biggest shows you've ever played at on in your life at that point?
Oh, absolutely. And they're the biggest shows I've ever played, period.
Yeah.
Played at Castle Donington in 95, opening for Metallica, and that was something like 150,000 people. I couldn't even see the end of the crowd, you know, and I was like,
wow,
good God. You know, there ain't this many people in Jasper at all.
Right.
Like 10 Jaspers.
It's like, at least.
So for never doing that before, I mean, is it scary?
Well, once we got into the touring part, the pressure did increase because I was expected to try to be a performer, and I'd never worked a big stage before in my life. So I do remember Slash and the tour manager at the time going, hey, man, why don't you step it up a little bit? You got a big stage here. You need to work this crowd. You need to communicate with people. And that was a huge, huge thing that I learned during that whole experience. I'm like, how do you sing 250,000 people?
Yeah.
You know, you have to give it 1,000%.
Yeah, I guess that's a big lesson to learn because if you've never done that, you wouldn't have a clue of what, you know, how you come off all the way in the back of that crowd. So, and I saw an interview with Bruce Dickinson years ago where he said, when you're playing arenas and stadiums and giant festival crowds, you have to think of the person all the way in the back and say, am I putting on a show for them, not just the people up front?
Yeah, you're completely naked and you better have a big set, you know, because a crowd like that can smell insecurity. They can smell anything that might be wrong. You need to go out and spell it out for people.
Nice. I like that.
Was there any major partying or pranks or anything going on during this tour? Like, how wild did it get on the road?
Well, the only thing I can say was a rock and roll band of its time, replete with all the trappings that one might encounter. But, we did a lot of touring. We did the States, you know, we went everywhere, all over the world. So not a lot of time to do too much partying.
Right. What was the farthest from home you ever got with them?
Oh, we went all over the world. We went to Singapore, Japan, Europe. We went to Australia, you know. It was a proper world tour.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I saw online it says 85 shows and you went to 19 different countries. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, this was the days when you had a record company promotion budget and they would fly you to do radio spots. And we were lucky in the sense that, you know, Slash being such a big name, that we did like a couple of months of promotion just flying around by ourselves. So we did Howard Stern and David Letterman, you know, the talk shows and stuff like that. So you really can feel like you're in the Rolling Stones.
Oh, I bet.
It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
So I know when this album came out, I loved it so much. And then years later, it's announced that Slash is going to come out with another Slash Snake Pit album. But when it comes out, it's a different singer. And I was upset by that at the time. Why didn't you participate when Slash's Snake Pit reconvened on down the line?
The long and short of it was I was already signed with Sony, with Imperial Drag. And Roger and I had been working on our music all through the Snake Pit days as well. So I had a commitment to him that I had to honor, and it was already legally binding since, you know, we'd signed the contracts. So parting is such sweet sorrow, but it had to be done. And then they got Rod, and I love Rod. I think Rod's an amazing singer as well. Ryan Roxy's in that lineup, Matt Logg, all good friends of mine. So it's just a different manifestation, a different facet of what Slash, you know, exploring his musicality.
Yeah. And on this record, you know, obviously it's 14 tracks. I don't know, we'll go track by track, but like what are some of the standout songs to you on this record that you have the best memories of making?
I love I love Beggars and Hangers-On because it was the first thing that I'd ever heard or contributed lyrics to. And I pretty much came out pure. Like, I wrote the lyrics on the spot when I auditioned, and with a few minor changes that Slash brought in, we had a song going and we were really proud of it. But I like songs like Good to Be Alive. I liked Lower, only because it was really low for me to sing. I'm a high tenor. And I just thought the riff was very strange. Slash would bring in an idea, like where the idea for the music came from. And I think in that case, that song was about Savannah. So, we hit some really dark subject matter on that record.
I read that one was about kind of a combination of Savannah and Kurt Cobain's suicides that he was touching on with that.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it was still fresh in our minds of losing Kurt. So I think in the middle of it, I'm just wondering as a kid, like, gosh, how low do you have to go, right?
Yeah.
Limbo.
Yeah, that song has got a super dark but still powerful vibe to it. I love that one. Guess you want to run down the list, do rapid fire? Give a little thought on each one of these songs on the album. There's a lot of them, man. I love that. Neither Can I. Any thoughts on that one? Memories of it?
That's another dark theme. That's really kind of about a friend of mine's dad who offed himself. So that was my inspiration for it. He'd put himself in a car and did the old exhaust pipe trick.
Oh.
And I was like, well, what would you say if it was you about to do the same thing? I think I just wrote it from a first person perspective. Trying to explain why I was doing this or the pain that I was in, whatever, you know.
I'm trying to feel what that person, I can dig that. Second song on the album, one of my all-time favorites. This one, Gilby Clark had a good hand in, a song called Dime Store Rock.
Right, yeah. That's kind of an L.A. song. That's a street song, you know. It's like, if you get out on the strip and you're living out in an apartment or a couch or whatever, like, there's a lot of unsavory shit goes on here. Or it did. I mean, it still does, of course, but it's just kind of, I just consider that kind of a street song.
And that one always stood out to me as, like, that's really a good Gilby Clark song. Like, when Pawn Shop Guitars came out, I remember thinking, man, that Dime Store Rock would fit on this album pretty damn good, too. She's gonna burn you out.
Yeah, it's just like anything that can evoke some kind of feeling of chaos was pretty important. I think on that number we were kind of aiming for that.
Big Gilby fan, love that guy. His last album is killer.
Oh yeah, I love Gilby.
All right, then the next track, we talked about this one a little bit earlier, Beggars and Hangers-On. You guys played it on Howard Stern. It was the video. I mean, this was the hit off the album. And your first chance to work with them, and man, you knocked it out of the park, and it ain't no wonder that they were impressed with what you did. Duff McKagan, it says, has a little hand in this one, too.
Yes, he does. And, well, that's sort of an introductory lyric to "Hello, my name is Eric, and I'll be replacing Axel for this portion of the show." So it's kind of my way of saying, I hope you like me. Also played into relationship things as well, so it's kind of a personal song in that regard. It's not really about GNR. I mean, there's still a personal twist to it. I think when somebody is in love with someone and they can't get through to them because they're being manipulated, you know, and that goes on a lot here, as you know.
On the performance you did with Slash on Howard Stern, I was watching that today, and you pretty much blew Howard away at the end of that with your vocals. And I saw that story where Slash said that, you know, when you were doing the record, he was worried about you because he was like, "Are you okay after doing that?" And you're like, "Yeah, let's just do another take." And he couldn't believe it.
Well, I'd had a lot of experience playing in bands around the Southeast for a number of years, and I was always the default lead singer. And I couldn't really sing that well when I first started out, but repetition and many rounds of having strep throat in my teens, I still got my tonsils, so, they're kind of like little flute holes or something, I don't know, but.
Let's talk about Good to Be Alive. What's your memories on that one?
Again, it's kind of another street song, you know? Just a reflection of being in the big city, you know, getting off the bus and going, "What the fuck is going on here?" People might talk about stories that they've had. I don't remember any offhand. Like I said, I was in a room by myself. I had a TV, but I didn't watch it. All I did was brew coffee and have speedballs with Jack Daniels. I'd just sit there and drink whiskey and coffee all day and just get like, if you know what that feels like, it feels like your brain's being pulled apart. But for some reason, it seemed to work at the time. So I was able to kind of get that one out.
Wow. And that song has got a good upbeat vibe to it. You know, you say there's some dark stuff on here, but that one's like a fun song, and I like that. It's got like that, like you talk about, like the Stones kind of vibe to
it. Yeah, absolutely. And we wanted that sense of fun.
Yeah, Stones on steroids. Track number 5, What Do You Want to Be? I love that one, too.
That's kind of more or less about high society. Well, I think it's funny today because you have all these influencers on the web or TikTok or whatever. I've heard it all a million times. You make me sicker than the wine you drink. So if you think I need some help, climb out of your own shell. It'll make you think. They're kind of chasing your dream of high society or being at the right parties or things of that nature. And that was a natural song to write because I'm not that person. Well, neither is Slash, really.
That's true. But you were surrounded by a lot of people that were that person in Hollywood in those days, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know, and it's you know, times have changed, but it's still the same. It's just moved into the web, the internet world, you know.
And then Monkey Chow, that's pretty much an all Gilby on that, right?
Right, that's Gilby. He wrote those lyrics, so you'd have to ask him.
So underrated, you know. Guns N' Roses, everybody just looked at him as the guy that replaced Izzy, but man, you know, his solo stuff, and such a good songwriter too, you know. He could have, I wish he would have had the opportunity to do more in GNR than just be like the replacement guy.
Yeah, I think GNR would have benefited greatly.
Track number 7, Sama City Ward. That one's actually got Izzy straddling.
Yes,
it's credited on there.
That's right. He did play on that one. It's just a song about utter insanity, about losing your shit, really. I mean, about being young and crazy, I guess. But winding up in a mental ward, you know, overdoing it.
You ever get to meet Izzy?
Yes, I have. He's a very, very wonderful gentleman. Easy going as they come.
And then up next is Jizz to Pit. That's the instrumental. That's a hard driving instrument. That's one of, I don't always like instrumentals on albums. I always like to have a singer. I think it's a, sometimes I hear an instrumental song and I think, yeah, they just ran out of time, or they didn't feel like adding lyrics to this, but they could have, you know. But Jizz to Pit is one that's fun instrumental jam. I don't have a problem with it.
Hey, you gotta let the musicians work out sometimes.
Yeah, give you a break.
That's right.
Because you still got a bunch of songs to go on here. Up next, we talked about it a little bit earlier, Lower. Man, such a groove on that song. I love that one.
Yeah, just Creepsville, Scoob. Totally.
Drink me. It's a nightmare. It's the
Number 10, Take It Away. That's another one, too, that's kind of got a little edge to it.
That's one of my favorites on the record.
Yeah, that's just a song about frustration. I think maybe, if anything, we all had a little bit of that frustration. Just take away the bullshit and let us get on with it, you know. I think that's probably the main impetus of where that came from.
Party's over and I'm
you want can't relate with that. Another one of my favorites on here. This is a fun song, Doing Fine. It's a party rocker.
It is indeed a party rocker.
We got a band playing. The singer's really fat. The cat is in the dryer. Who's the asshole who did that? Someone's in the back room. I think they're getting high. If they don't unlock the bathroom, I'll just have to go outside. Got no worries. Moving right along. And what a great night, babe. To do what you think is wrong.
And it just kind of... That one... at least lyrically for me, came from, you know, growing up in Jasper and always used to play with older guys, you know, that were at least 7 to 10 years older. So we'd play parties down by the river and raise hell. And, if, you know, you being from the South, you know that people down there know how to raise hell. So.
Yeah, and the best parties are always down by the river.
Yeah, down by the river, exactly. So, there was a certain party that I played in, you know, when I was young that that's where I got all the inspiration from. I still remember the party like yesterday. And I didn't have sex with any strange women, I promise. It was just a wild Southern bunch of people getting together and raising hell, like Jesco or something, you know.
All right, that brings us up to track 11, Be the Ball.
Yeah, this one's a little odd. I read in an interview that like it's basically written from the perspective of you're a pinball in a game, but then I saw something where it was somehow inspired by Hunter S. Thompson. Is that true?
Yeah, I would say both. You know, I would say that's the most zen song on the record. There's really no other way to describe that one other than it, you know, be the ball, be the change. You know, you can, if you put yourself in that place of being the pinball, you can learn a lot about yourself.
I was just hoping it was a Caddyshack reference, but I was wrong.
I think maybe a little bit, because if I'm not mistaken, I think Slash brought that title. I think that he was like, yeah. Hey man, I've got this idea for a title. As a, you know, I would write the bulk of everything and the titles, but it, you know, we worked together as well. So he brought that title.
That reminds me of an interview I watched with the two of you. I think it was a Japanese interview where they start off the interview with like, well, so this is your new solo project. And he was real fast to be like, no, this is not a solo project. This is a band. It seemed like he was adamant on saying this is not a solo thing. This is a band project, which was probably pretty gratifying for all of you guys that put this thing together.
He was more than gracious with, you know, giving credit where credit's due. And that's, you know, another reason that he has that understanding of how to roll with it, you know.
How to be the ball.
That's right.
All right. Then we got track 13. See, I mean, I say it again and again. Oh, this is one of my favorites. Oh, this is one of my favorite songs on the album. This is one of my favorite songs on the album. Here we go. Track 13 is one of my favorite songs on the album. I Hate Everybody But You. What a love song. You got to have that sweet love ballad, right?
Yeah, well, we've all felt that way. And, well, I think too, if you're in some kind of high-profile band like GNR was, it's, you know, you get a little bit insulated from real life. too, because you're on a bus or you're on a plane, you're playing in an arena. So those feelings will come up rather naturally. Whether you're in GNR or not, if you're just in any kind of band that's toured around and played for people, you just get this, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, you're cool, fuck you. I mean, it's kind of one of those songs.
Yep. We've all been there.
Yeah.
That's one thing I noticed about this album, you know, for the time it came out, there is no cheesy love ballads on it at all.
Yep.
No.
I appreciate that.
It just wouldn't have been right. You know, the formula, too, was, you know, the 80s, you always had to have a love ballad. You know, you had to have Heaven by Warren. I mean, great songs, you know, great for what they were. But we were like, we don't want to be touched. We don't bathe. We live in our leathers. You know, if you want to go get a drink with us, that's cool. But what's love got to do with it? So
I appreciate that. And then we round off the album, 14 strong-ass tracks, and we wrap it up with Back and Forth Again. It's such a shame how little things can change your mind. Don't just sit there filing your nails and passing the time. I can let you.
That might be my second favorite song on the record, just because I think it's a beautiful 6/8. It does approach ballad territory, but it stays more Stonesy than it does pop song, you know. So I think there's like a bluesy grit to the song that you know, I love to this day.
What a freaking awesome album, clocking in at just under 70 minutes long. Man, you guys gave it to us good, and you gave it to us a lot. You got quantity and quality. You can't ask for much more.
One
of my favorite albums of all time, man. We appreciate you taking the time to break it all down for us. From Slash to Snake Pit, you know, you go right back to Imperial Drag. We've talked about that album on the show before, too. I highly recommend that album. That's some great stuff, too.
Yeah, we love that stuff.
Yeah, right on. I mean, you know, Roger and I at that point were doing, we were into 70s garage rock, 60s garage rock, 70s. We weren't going to make a record like Snake Pit, kind of going a little bit older school, maybe a touch more retro.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a good time as well.
Yeah, I have to mention, we'd love to have you back on at some point if you want to do one of these for The Eyes of Alice Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
Because we both love that record, and especially your contributions to it. Thank you for writing Novocaine. That song is just...
Oh, right on. Yeah. Another, you know, loads of stories there as well. And so super, just super grateful to be able to work with Alice and Roxy.
Do you ever talk to Slash anymore?
Not that often. Occasionally, you know, it'll be a hello, but I'm really more... I keep in touch with him through the guys in the band, Todd Kearns, Brent Fitz, and
oh, yeah.
I'm buddies with all those guys. I mean, you know, so we kind of peripherally say hey and whatnot.
Right on. That's cool. And you got some awesome stuff going on right now. The Licorice Quartet.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. It's coming out May 20th, I think, officially. And we did... the third EP is now available. It's called Threesome Volume 3. And it's Roger Manning Jr. and Tim Smith from Jellyfish. So it's a bit of a pop, exploratory pop project. Kind of a celebration of our friendship because we hadn't played together in years, written together. And yeah, definitely check it out. We just released all three EPs on Sony Japan as an import.
Nice.
So if you don't find the EPs by themselves here in the States, you can buy the import and get the whole record.
Right on. And from what I've heard off of that, that's kind of got a little, I mean, obviously it's got a little bit of Imperial Drag flavor to it because it's got you and Roger both on it, but it's got that same kind of like 70s English glam kind of vibe to it a little bit from some of the stuff I've heard. You guys going to be doing any shows with that or anything?
The likelihood of that is very slim, since Roger plays with Beck. Roger does loads of sessions for all kinds of people. Morrissey, Beck. He's a full-time member in Beck's band. Tim and I do different projects as well. I've got my own project with Sextus, which I've released two records with that. So kind of knew going in that we weren't going to be doing any shows, proper live shows. We might do a live stream coming up in the future, kind of a stripped down version. So I'm looking forward to that if it happens.
That's cool. Yeah, you definitely have to keep us updated on that. We'll let everybody know about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, definitely. And we're going to add, we'll add links to all your projects in the show notes for this episode, and we'll share that through our channels. Do you ever make it back to Alabama anymore these days?
I go as often as I can. Which is not very often because I'm usually quite busy, but I do like to go and see my father. He's up there in age, and I hope to get back soon to see him. My brother and sister live there, so it's home. I left 28 years ago or something, but it's still nice to go back and still keep in touch with all my school chums. So
nice. Where's the best place people keep up with everything Eric Dover?
Oh, goodness. Well, you can go to the licoricequartet.com, and that's the latest thing that I'm involved with, obviously. I think there's a Sextus Bandcamp page that has some tracks on it. I don't have an official website yet for Sextus, but that's going to be coming up in the future as I'm working on tracks for a new record on that right now as well.
Nice. Looking forward to that. Well, if we're going to ride on out of here and we're going to play a song on the way out by the Licorice Quartet, what do you recommend for everybody to check out?
Why don't you play a song called New Days? We just made a video for it, and it's very, very 60s feeling type of track. And I'm really happy with how it came out. I'm really happy with the way the whole record came out. It took 5 years for us to do it because right in the middle of it, the pandemic struck. So we had to finish things from our respective home studios. So, but I like the feeling of it. I like the lyrics and the vibe. So, yeah, spin that one.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, thanks, man, for hanging out with us and regaling us with tales of rock and roll, man. We loved it.
Hey, thanks, guys. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks. Hope to have you back on in the future. It was fun.
Yeah, we'll do it again sometime.
Awesome. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay, guys. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Bye. Thanks, man.
Turn a page. Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.